Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Franklin County Prosecutor Ron O'Brien has charged former Mount Carmel physician William Husel with 25 counts of murder, accusing him of ordering excessive doses of pain medication for patients who died not long after taking them. O'Brien said that anything above 500 micrograms of fentanyl can be considered enough for a murder charge, and that all 25 victims in the criminal case were given at least that much. O'Brien likened Husel actions to prematurely extinguishing a candle.
That candle, while there may just be a half an inch of wax left, if I blow that candle out, I'm causing that flame to go out sooner than it would naturally. And I think in likening it to what occurred in some of the cases here, that's a similar circumstance.
WOSU reporter Paige Flager has been covering the story. She joins us now. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ann.
Husel has pleaded not guilty to the charges, right?
Yes, that's
correct. What's kind of next in this process?
So Husel, I'm not positive of this, but I believe that Husel made bail. His lawyer was pretty sure that he'd be able to do that so that he could go home and be with his family. He, as far as the case, there's no trial date set yet. And it's interesting because this is one of those situations where it's the state has this criminal case. Then there are also a myriad of civil cases, and there's investigations from the Ohio Board of Medicine and things like that. So you're kind of seeing, you're going to see a domino effect.
So we've got the county cases. We've got the state, you said, could
yes.
be filing or has filed?
Well, so technically this criminal case, the 25 murder charges, is the state of Ohio versus William Husel.
Okay. Franklin County Prosecutor Ron O'Brien has said that a 500 microgram dose of fentanyl warrants a murder charge. How did he come to that conclusion?
So it seems to me what he said yesterday was that in the last 6 months since they started this investigation into Husel and his conduct at Mount Carmel, they've been working with medical experts basically to kind of try and dictate that point, the amount of fentanyl that is considered excessive. And mm-hmm. this has been a question, I think, the whole time is what is kind of considered comfort care, end of life care to make someone comfortable? What's an appropriate dose? And that's a question that I think is very gray in the medical literature. Mm-hmm. O'Brien seems to believe, based on what his medical experts have told him, that 500 and above means that there was some sort of intention to hasten death, to quicken the speed at which someone died.
It's a kind of a question of excessive versus a term that might seem better, which is lethal.
Right. Yeah. And you'll hear the O'Brien, the prosecutor's office, saying lethal. I'm not sure that I'm comfortable using the word lethal all the time in all of these cases, because the thing with fentanyl is it's kind of when it's given to someone, it suppresses their breath. And so if someone is intubated, if they're on a breathing tube and they're given 500 micrograms of fentanyl, then they can survive that because they are breathing still. They have a way to keep breathing. But in these cases, these were what's called a palliative extubation. So it means the tube was being taken out. This is kind of Husel would have dictated that this person, there wasn't much more he could do. He wanted to make them comfortable at the end of life. And that was a conversation he had with some of these families.
Right. That popped up in what I've read about it is pretty routinely asked people if they wanted to
make people comfortable.
Life-saving measures and have a do not resuscitate order.
Exactly, yeah. And in those cases, when you're taking out that tube and fentanyl is given, then that would kind of suppress breathing. Because basically at the end of life, it's a pretty unpleasant process after you take that tube out, because the person, depending on how much feeling they still have left in their bodies, it's essentially you're suffocating. And so something like fentanyl kind of slows the system down, slows the process down, so someone wouldn't be gasping for air.
Gotcha. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Franklin County Prosecutor Ron O'Brien has charged former Mount Carmel physician William Husel with 25 counts of murder. They accuse him of ordering excessive doses of pain medication for patients who died not long after taking them. My guest right now is WOSU reporter Paige Flager. She's been covering the story since it broke late last year. It was about December 5th that Mount Carmel referred questions about these cases to the authorities.
That's right. Yeah. December 5th was when Husel was fired from working at the hospital, although it's worth noting he was taken off patient duty in late November. So there was kind of a
hospital started to investigate.
Exactly. Yeah. There was a period of time there where he still was employed at the hospital, but he was not interacting with patients. And then he was fired December 5th, which was when Mount Carmel alerted the proper authorities.
At first, they claimed that all the patient victims were close to death, and the hospital has since walked that back. What's going on there?
Yeah, so the original statement was that all the patients were near death, and then you have this doctor kind of hastening that process, which I think a lot of people felt was egregious and problematic.
But
then it later came out. Well, a lot of the families, when they started filing these civil cases and coming forward to tell their stories, there were a lot of kind of discrepancies. And I'm sure you'll hear from Schroyer later, David Schroyer, the lawyer, and other lawyers in these cases, that there were a lot of discrepancies, I think, from what the families remember about the timing of things and whether or not their loved one was actually brain dead or these types of things. So those questions started kind of coming up after the news broke. And then a couple months into kind of the investigation, the hospital came out and said that there were actually 5 patients who potentially could have survived their conditions. Now, it's worth noting that does not necessarily mean that those people would have been able to just walk out of the hospital, right? Like, it doesn't mean that they would have made a full and complete recovery. But the hospital did say that maybe had they gotten different medical care,
they may have been able to survive and have some kind of quality of life.
Depending.
What do we know about what kind of oversight the hospital has when it comes to intensive care physicians?
Yeah, so that's a big question. Yeah. So I think an important fact about this case is that Husel worked third shift. He was the overnight doctor in the ICU.
So not as much moment to moment.
Exactly. But it's also a question of oversight on the overnight shifts, because I think it's kind of come out, and I've talked to many nurses and pharmacists who work in the hospital, and I think it's come out over and over again that oftentimes Husel was the only doctor who was working in the ICU during those periods of time. So if Husel, say, has a patient in, he orders a prescription for 500 or more fentanyl.
There's no one to consult with.
Yeah, and even many of the nurses who worked that shift were early in their career. This was one of their first jobs, and I've heard from many of them that Husel was a really good teacher. Even if they would question him about the amount of the doses, he would give an explanation. And you have to kind of put it in the context of the fact that, like, he came from the Cleveland Clinic, a residency at the Cleveland Clinic, which is one of the most revered hospitals. He had a background in anesthesiology, so sedation was something that he was kind of an expert in.
Right.
And so when these nurses and pharmacists received these orders, one, they didn't really have someone that they could go to, and two, Husel would give deemed reasonable explanations to why he was ordering these doses. But I think it is worth noting that some pharmacists and nurses that I spoke to said that they questioned Husel first, then they sometimes raised his dosing levels to their direct superiors. So you're talking about, like, the nursing supervisor or people like that. And generally that didn't really go anywhere, it seems. So whether or not people were having a conversation with Husel, like higher ups were having conversations with Husel
the next day or something like that. Yeah.
And also, I think there was a lot of blame put upon the hospital. Like, how did you not know about this? But I think the hospital, a hospital structure, like any workplace, is a very complicated structure full of hierarchies, right? And so if it got raised to someone superior, it doesn't necessarily mean it reached the highest levels of the officer or of the building.
What is the liability for Mount Carmel Hospital System at this point?
So that's a good question. Mount Carmel is not named in this criminal case. So Husel is the only person that is having these murder charges brought against him. Mount Carmel is named in the myriad of civil cases that have been brought against Husel and Mount Carmel and several nurses and pharmacists. They have been kind of in a process, an ongoing process, with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. It's a federal kind of group that oversees whether or not people, hospitals are doing their due diligence to set up a proper environment to take care of patients who would use Medicare or Medicaid. They've been in a process with them fixing different protocols when it comes to pharmacy services, so the ability to get medication, some stuff with just like general building maintenance, some stuff with the reporting process itself. So basically, the hospital has been working with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid and the Ohio Department of Health to kind of figure out where things maybe went wrong and tighten up those procedures.
The dispatch has referenced how Husel charmed nurses and used his experience with the Cleveland Clinic, as you mentioned, to get them and others to listen to him. What do we know about his personality?
So it's interesting. I think the way that sounds to me, and the way that maybe that's being painted, is that he was sort of taking advantage of these people who maybe had less experience.
Well, I kind of read it as a charismatic type of personality.
Yeah, yeah.
That naturally,
I have heard definitely more that it's charismatic as opposed to that
charming.
It's predatory.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yes,
like, it's not like he's preying on
right.
these
Right, that's
these
what I get.
Nurses.
I get a charisma thing versus a predator thing.
Yeah, I've heard from basically anyone that I've talked to inside the hospital structure that worked with him that he was a really good teacher, that there are a lot of doctors who maybe don't take the time to talk with lower level nurses or pharmacists about the reasons that they're doing what they're doing, and that Husel was somebody that a lot of people felt like they could question. And so I think that's something that maybe even made this possible for longer, was the fact that Husel was a very, it seems from what I've heard, Husel was a very open person. And so a nurse, instead of maybe questioning Husel to their supervisor, would just go to Husel and be like, what's the purpose of a 1,000 microgram dose of fentanyl? And Husel would have an open dialogue with these people about why he was doing what he was doing.
Right. And then also obviously he was a third shift, so people are coming in the middle of the night.
Right.
And when they're being asked to approve do not resuscitate orders and that kind of a thing, have you seen any kind of pattern among the victims' families about, you know, what their experience was in dealing in that moment?
In the moment, yeah. I think the reason that this case has kind of become as noteworthy as it has is the fact that it kind of questions this trust that you have when you go into a doctor and you put your loved one's life in the hands of another person, right? You trust that person to be the expert and to do what they're supposed to do. And so I think it seems to me a pattern that is rising is kind of that these people were told that there weren't really any other options for their loved ones, and they believed the doctor. You also see that from nurses and pharmacists, too. It's worth noting, like, they raised these questions, and they, too, believed the doctor. And so it's kind of, and we'll get to this soon, but that's kind of one of the reasons that you're not seeing nurses and pharmacists in these criminal cases.
They weren't the authorities in each of these
exactly.
incidents.
Yeah. And hospitals, I think, from what I understand, are a pretty notorious. It's a hierarchy for
mm-hmm.
sure. And
yeah.
the doctor is the expert. And people like nurses and pharmacists, while they do have a duty to the patient under Ohio law, they also report directly to the doctor.
Does anybody have any inkling of motives?
No. So the thing with that is I think, pretty interesting is O'Brien, Ron O'Brien, the prosecutor, is arguing he doesn't need to prove motive or
in order to bring
these murder charges forward. If he wanted to do motive, he would have charged him, or he felt like he could kind of meet the burden of proof for some sort of motive or intent or premeditation, then that would have been an aggravated murder, which is a capital charge.
Which assumes a premeditation.
Exactly, yeah. So these murder charges, he basically said yesterday, like, we don't need to prove intent, nor do we know intent, because Husel hasn't spoken. And Husel's lawyer, I talked to him yesterday, and he was very tight-lipped as well, so...
That's Paige Flager, WSU reporter, who's been covering the William Husel case. To repeat, Franklin County Prosecutor Ron O'Brien has charged former Mount Carmel physician William Husel with 25 counts of murder. They accuse him of ordering excessive doses of pain medication for patients who died not long after taking them. We will continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment about the case, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Former Mount Carmel physician William Husel has pled not guilty to 25 counts of murder involving his part in prescribing life-ending doses of pain medication to intensive care patients. Husel, whose license has been suspended by the state, could face 15 years to life for each charge. Still with us is WOSU reporter Paige Flager. Kelly Dineen is a former intensive care unit nurse and now director of the health law program at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, where she studies legal policy surrounding pain treatment. She joins us by phone. Welcome, Kelly Dineen.
Thank you.
Your 2016 article about how physicians can prescribe opioids for pain while avoiding legal sanction was published in the American Journal of Law and Medicine. What is the medical legal balancing act for doctors on this score?
Well, you know, it's become even harder these days because of all of the very real concerns about the opioid crisis, right?
Right.
But, you know, doctors have to, in all things, decide what's in the best interest of their patient, right? And opioids carry some benefit for people and carry harms, right? So they have to balance out at all times, is the benefit, does it override associated harm. This case is kind of stretches the boundaries of that, right? Because I think there's probably not a rational argument that the doses given could really be said to have been a benefit to the patient.
You've written about something called the 4D model that policymakers use to determine overprescription of pain medication. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So this was a model that went back to the 1980s that was really sort of not empirically tested, right? So it wasn't like an evidence-based model. It was literally a couple of really bright physicians who studied doctors who got into trouble for prescribing problems. And they said, well, we think this might be a good way to categorize people. So they proposed this idea, and then it got adopted very quickly by the American Medical Association and then just taken up and sort of indoctrinated into many state licensing boards, for example. So they said the 4Ds were doctors who were duped, meaning fooled by patients who weren't really in pain, dated, meaning not in line with current practices, dishonest, which is probably not the right word at all because the dishonest cases tend to go more toward the criminal, and disabled. So providers who have their own, perhaps their own addiction or other healthcare problems that impair their judgment, right, or cognitive problems, for example. But when you really test it out, it doesn't hold water well, given what we know about prescribing problems today.
Why not? I mean, why not those 4Ds?
Right. Well, so Duke is problematic, and so many people believe this is sort of run through common culture, or sort of our general understanding, as well as throughout the medical industry, this idea that doctors can sort of be lie detectors, that they know in the rare case that, say, somebody is working for a criminal diversion enterprise, right? And so they're going to doctors, making up symptoms, right? Again, I have to say that is exceedingly rare. But if you look at, like, the good social science research, people, even experienced people, aren't lie detectors. Even people who have been trained, for the most part, only get a little bit above 50% accuracy. So it's really like the flip of a coin, right? And that's why things like prescription drug monitoring programs and other kinds of tools have come into play now in hopes of catching that kind of a problem. Again, exceedingly rare. Dishonest is just not strong enough because people in that category are those that actually really have traded in their medical model for criminal enterprise. So,
well, the pill mills, that kind of a thing.
Pill mills, exchanging prescriptions for sex,
okay.
You know, that kind of thing. The things we hear about occasionally, right? And then, disabled is not a bad category, but I think it makes more sense to just call it something like compromised by impairment, because people can have disabilities that don't affect their prescribing practice at all, right? So with dishonest, I suggested changing the name to corrupt, because that really captures the essence of what's happening there.
Is there into which of these categories, or is there a category for inept?
I'm careless.
Okay.
So that would be a category, and that kind of gets to not staying up with the literature or being so overworked that they make mistakes and aren't careful.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the case of former Mount Carmel physician William Husel. Well, we're not talking about the case, but we're talking about the issues surrounding the case of former Mount Carmel physician William Husel. He's been charged with 25 counts of murder. He's been accused of ordering excessive doses of pain medication for patients who died not long after taking those. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Kelly Dineen is the director of the health law program at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska. She's also a former intensive care unit nurse. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We also have with us WOSU reporter Paige Flager. She's been covering the issue. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Kelly Dineen, from your experience as an ICU nurse, how does pain management differ in that environment versus others?
Well, it's not unusual to give pain medicine at the end of life, right? So if somebody truly is in a state where they are in all likelihood not going to recover, and either they or more likely they are not no longer conscious or perhaps not able to make that decision, their family decides they don't want to do sort of intensive measures. They want the person to pass peacefully.
Mm-hmm.
It's not unusual to give some pain medication,
right?
To reduce suffering, to change, to reduce labored breathing, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all a matter of measure and context, right? So for somebody who isn't on opioids in a daily way, right, you would start with, if you were going to use fentanyl, right, you would start with a dose of like 50 micrograms, and see how they did, right? These huge doses are quite perplexing to me, the whole thing is very perplexing to me, especially given my background in terms of the nurse's role and not refusing to administer them.
You know, Paige Flager mentioned earlier that William Heusel worked the third shift, which is a lot less oversight and a lot more dependence on that one physician who's on duty, which was him. Does that resonate with you?
A little bit, but, you know, ICU nurses are pretty darn independent, right? And they have to really, you know, a nurse's obligation, number one obligation, is to stand up for the patient, to advocate for the patient. It's not to blindly follow orders, right? Mm-hmm. And so just following orders is not going to be a defense. It shouldn't be a defense for nurses at any time, right? They have to exercise their own judgment. And ICU nurses are experienced with appropriate doses for pain medication, among other meds, right? But I cannot see, and I think it's appropriate that they've been suspended, but I cannot see allowing any kind of personal relationship or personal affinity get in the way of that obligation to the patient.
Kelly, I guess it's Paige here. I guess I'm curious what you think about the fact that some of these ICU nurses, this was maybe their first job out of training. This was their first job on the floor of a hospital.
They get stuck on the third shift, kind of a thing.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. So that's interesting. Although, you know, that goes to, and I don't know the details of the training they were put through, but for example, when I went into ICU nursing, I was paired up, whether third shift or, you know, no matter what shift, right? I was paired up with a very experienced ICU nurse for, I believe, 6 to 8 weeks before I could take care of a patient on my own. Even though I had done plenty of clinicals, I had worked in the ICU as a student nurse because, you know, you hold people's lives in your hands, especially when you only have one doctor. You know, people live or die or they suffer based on a nurse's independence and ability to think critically about what's going on and what's being ordered. And I would say on night shifts in particular, doctors are often tired. I mean, perhaps it's even more important that third shift nurses be vigilant and, you know, respectfully questioning and then refusing. You know, it would not be unusual. I thankfully didn't have anything like this exactly come up, but, you know, the appropriate response would be, I think you might have made an error in this order. And if they said no, and you question it respectfully, would be to say, you know, I cannot do that. If you feel it's appropriate to give that to the patient, you will have to do it yourself.
Yeah. Well, and I think it is worth noting that in a lot of these cases, these nurses, I think it's difficult because Heusel had been at the hospital for working at the hospital since 2013. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's hard for some of the nurses, at least from the nurses I've spoken to in the recent cases, even if they did ask a colleague or a higher up colleague or somebody in a different department, like a pharmacist or something like that, like, hey, I got this weird prescription order from Heusel. Heusel was kind of notorious from the very beginning for giving higher doses. And from what I've heard from pharmacists and nurses, a lot of them say that, like, it kind of became a thing that even if you had asked your colleague, they would have been like, oh, yeah, that's Heusel.
They attributed it to
his anesthesiology background in a lot of ways.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and I, you know, obviously, I have the utmost sympathy for the nurses and other healthcare providers. But the thing is that all the checks and balances that we have in healthcare only work if people are in a position to have the moral courage to stand up and refuse if necessary. I mean, I do empathize and that, you know, obviously he was in a position of power and it's very, very, very hard to stand up in response to that. But I can speak to nursing training. It is all about advocating for your patient, thinking critically, and refusing when you feel that it's the order is completely inappropriate. And those doses, there's people that vary a little bit, right, higher, lower, but they seem pretty out of context. Like I could see 50 to 100, but then to start with, say 500, it seems
or 1,000 in some cases.
Right. Seems like, wow. It's like, oh, you know, and this is not a great analogy, but like the aspirin bottle takes 1 or 2.
Suddenly take 8. I want to talk to you about another relationship in this process, and that's between the medical personnel and the family. These were all third shift cases, and people are bringing their loved one in the middle of the night. They're tired, they're confused, and they're scared. And I'm wondering about that, asking somebody to declare something like a do not resuscitate order for a loved one in the middle of the night like that. I'm not sure I would do that. I would say, well, I want to get another opinion tomorrow morning. Let's keep them on, whatever,
right,
until tomorrow morning. Now, I'm not blaming the families, but I'm wondering about doing that in the middle of the night, if that's always the wisest thing in terms of giving them the chance to think it through.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a food for thought. I mean, definitely my experience, it did happen, but there's always sort of a period of absorption, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, think about the, I'm sorry.
Sorry, I interrupted.
No, you go ahead, Paige.
I was just going to say, I think in some of these cases, even the families have said that Husel or somebody from the hospital would call in the middle of the night. Like, they'd send them home and say your loved one is in stable condition for right now, and then they would get a phone call in the middle of the night. One of the people, he went back to Cleveland and then had to drive back to Columbus in the middle of the night to kind of make this decision in person. So I do think there is something to be said about whether or not,
is that a good thing to be doing?
Right.
Then.
Right, right. And that's, that is, and again, how could the families possibly know? That's the most heartbreaking part of this, But perhaps the waiting period, perhaps some other process to be put in place.
Hey, Kelly, Deneen, before I let you go, I'm kind of interested in the fact that, you're a former ICU nurse, and then you went into law, and that you study the issues surrounding liability and pain medication. What got you into that? What's the issue that you thought that struck you that as a point of research?
Well, so I was an ICU nurse. In my last 7 years, and I worked with a neurosurgeon that took care of patients who literally had no other option with chronic pain,
mm-hmm.
Where they hadn't responded to any kind of treatment. So he would sometimes do surgeries and things on them, and so I became intimately familiar with the population of people with severe chronic pain and how much they suffered and how much stigma and flat out discrimination there is against people who have chronic pain, mm-hmm. and people who have substance use disorders. And then when I went to law school, I had the good fortune of working for a professor who was working on using law to try and improve the lives of people with pain. And so that's how I got interested.
Hmm. Well, Kelly Deneen, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Kelly Deneen, Director of the Health Law Program at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska. She's also a former ICU nurse. Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation about the case of William Husel. He's a former Mount Carmel physician. He has pled not guilty to 25 counts of murder involving his part in prescribing doses of pain medication to intensive care patients at levels at which he's accused of killing them with. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Former Mount Carmel physician William Husel has pled not guilty to 25 counts of murder involving his part in prescribing life-ending doses of pain medication to intensive care patients. Husel, whose license has been suspended by the state, could face 15 years to life for each charge. Still with us is WOSU reporter Paige Flager. Attorney David Schroyer represents the families of four of the victims involved in the charges. He's a former assistant U.S. attorney and also a former assistant county prosecutor here in Franklin County. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
The patients that Husel was seeing were in critical care. It wasn't like an emergency room situation. They were in the critical care unit, ICU. What kind of legal precedent is there when it comes to charging a doctor with hastening the death versus causing the death? I'm not sure the distinction. It sounds like exactly the same thing.
Yeah, and actually it is the same thing. Okay. And I think Ron O'Brien used an apt example of your life is like a candle, and you've got the flame, and we don't know how much wax is left. But what happened in this case, regardless of how much wax was left, Husel snuffed out the flame by giving the fentanyl, the overdoses of the fentanyl.
Is there any legal precedent on this score?
Well, I don't know of any. You know, you think back to Swango, and that was my early days as an attorney.
Yeah.
That was a little different than this, but the effect was the same, early death, early demise. It's hard to imagine that things like this happen, but, you know, hospitals are supposed to have in place procedures that stop this from happening, and that's why you don't see more of this. Procedures that nurses going up the chain of command and procedures that alert to overdoses, whether it be intentional or inadvertent.
Mm-hmm.
Those apparently weren't in place at Mount Carmel.
He's not being charged with premeditated murder, and if he had been, he'd be facing capital punishment. What kind of role does it play in the case going forward that prosecutors did not determine these incidents were premeditated?
Well, you know, they can still argue they're premeditated. The death penalty is off the table, obviously, based upon the charge. Death penalty cases are pretty hard to get convictions on, as we recently saw in some recent cases. So I think it was a smart move by Prosecutor Ron O'Brien to bring the murder charges and not a death penalty charge.
Are you satisfied with what's come out of the prosecutor's office at this point?
Yes, very much so. Our families are very satisfied with the hard work that the Columbus Police Department did. And Prosecutor Ron O'Brien has been reaching out to the families, making sure they're informed of everything, and they've done a fantastic job. They've got a great trial staff down there to try this case.
What do you think about that 5 megagram?
500 micrograms.
500 micrograms of fentanyl distinction, David Schroyer?
Yeah, I can tell you what our experts tell us. There's no justifiable reason for giving more than 200 to 250.
Regardless of the size of a person or anything like that?
Regardless of the size, that's what our experts tell us. And because that's going to cause death unless you have supported breathing. So the only exception to giving higher doses of fentanyl is if you have a ventilator in place breathing for you, because you will stop breathing. And that's exactly what happened in these cases. So 500 is beyond any pale. I mean, there is no physician in America that will say that it is appropriate and under the standard of care to give 500 micrograms of fentanyl without being on a respirator or without being on a ventilator.
Another thing that intrigues me about all of this is the point of contact between the medical personnel, whether it was a nurse or the physician, with the families of the patients and asking them These were all third shift situations in the middle of the night, asking them to make the decision for a DNR, a do not resuscitate order, and that kind of a thing. What about that?
Yeah, there's protocols you're supposed to follow in that. And in our cases, Husel was telling some of our patients that your loved one is brain dead. Now, in order to determine brain death, that usually is a 2-day process, not a 2-hour process.
Mm-hmm.
They were up in the ICU for less than 2 hours. And in one case, he was tapping his watch, saying, we need to do this at midnight, tapping his watch. What's his motive here? I guess we'll find out. We've asked for his deposition. He's You know, there's a motion to stay that until the criminal case is over, so we'll have to see what happens there.
Yeah.
But again, we don't have to prove motive, just as the prosecutor doesn't have to prove motive.
Right.
David, it's Paige. I guess I'm curious. One thing that I heard from O'Brien yesterday, and like you just touched on, is this situation with motive or premeditation for these civil cases. Is that something that you are going to be trying to prove? Or from your familiarity with the medical files and stuff like that, do you think that you have a case to argue that this was premeditated or that he was calculated in what he was doing?
Well, I mean, he had to have known what he was doing. I mean, there's no one, no medical doctor in America would say that these dosages were anywhere close to being appropriate or therapeutic. They were meant to cause death. So we don't have to prove motive. We just have to prove that he negligently took actions that resulted in the death. You know, it's interesting. In 2014, apparently there was one case. In 2015, there were four cases. There were no cases in 2016. And then in 2017, 11 cases, another 11 in 2018. So it seemed to be really ramping up. So I don't know what was going on that caused that.
Well, and you can see it when you're looking at all of these, the cases that are involved in O'Brien's case, the dose of fentanyl started off around 500. And
that
then
escalated as well.
Escalated to 2,000 was the very last case.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
So
yeah, exactly.
We just heard from Kelly Deneen. She's director of the Health Law program at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, and also a former ICU nurse. And she was saying she had her thoughts about the culpability of nurses and pharmacists in these cases, given these, you know, what ramped up to be 1,000 micrograms, 2,000 in some cases, way beyond the pale compared to the 50 to 100 that's recommended. What do you think about them not charging any of the nurses or pharmacists in this case?
Well, could they have been subject to some sort of charge? Yes, probably. I think the prosecutor's office decided to treat them as witnesses. Husel was the motivating force behind all of this. He was trying to convince the nurses that he had the proper credentials and knew what he was doing, and some nurses questioned it. The problem is the nurses did not go up the chain of command. This is a cultural issue. Hospitals train their employees to go up the chain of command, or supposed to at least. And apparently that didn't happen in this case. Concerning the pharmacists, they would have had to have known that these were lethal doses.
Mm-hmm.
They were ordered as a one IV push. They weren't ordered to be given a little bit over a long period of time. It's interesting what Husel did in many of these cases is he used the emergency override on the Pyxis machine to have the nurses draw the medicines up. And so you go to the machine that's sitting on the floor, the nurse puts her fingerprint on it, puts her initials on it, opens up, the drawer opens up with the fentanyl. To do 1,000 cc, she pulls out 20 vials, loads up the 20 vials because there's 50 in each vial. I mean, wouldn't you think an alarm would go off saying, hey, this doesn't seem quite right? At any rate, these were emergency overrides. Then the information circles back to the pharmacy after the fact, the pharmacy to approve the order.
Mm-hmm.
There's no emergency reason to give to extubate a patient. There is no emergency reason to extubate a patient. There are a lot of emergency reasons to intubate. So here he's using some sort of an emergency override.
You mean there's no emergency reason to withdraw the breathing tube?
No.
Right. Okay, gotcha. No, I just want to make sure.
It can wait an hour. It can wait 2 days, as it should have.
Gotcha.
It's worth noting in these cases, since it came to light what was going on, that those are actually some of the things, the steps that Mount Carmel has been taking. They're working on the overrides of the Pyxis, the machine that kind of allows people to have access to medication and what constitutes an emergency and the people you have to consult when you are doing a withdrawal of the breathing tube,
mm-hmm.
an extubation.
That's part of the things.
Exactly. And none of that was done in this case. Why weren't those procedures in place? And that's a big part of the plaintiff's case, is the hospital involvement here and the protocols that they had in place. So you've got the nurses not going up the chain of command to the nurse supervisor and on up from there. You've got the pharmacist apparently not looking at the orders or not following up on those. Then you've got this whole issue about, you know, the one nice thing about medical records we have today, electronic medical records, is that you can have them programmed to to say, this alert, this is an overdose. Don't give this, whether it's inadvertent or, in this case, on purpose. That would have given the nurses a little bit more of a backbone to say, doctor, I've got an alert here. I'm not going to give this. The nurses are an advocate for their patient, mm-hmm. not for the doctor. The more insistent that the doctor is, the more insistent the nurse should be on not doing it. So they have a total independent obligation to their patients, and they failed them in over 30 cases. And there's multiple personnel involved here. I mean, we've got 25 or so personnel that were involved with approving or giving these dosages of medication. That brings to light then what is the culture, what is the training to call into question the doctor's order. Let's look at a totally different situation. Let's suppose the doctor meant to order 100, and he actually ordered 1,000 because he put an extra zero on.
Right.
That's going to be missed too. I mean, this is a dangerous situation to not have these protocols in place. The protocols are designed to protect the patient, and those apparently were not working in this case. And in the civil case, that's going to be one of the things we want to know from discovery as to why, what was this system in place, why didn't it work, and then all of our clients have been saying, look, we want to make sure this doesn't happen to somebody else at some other time in some other hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's done now and the publicity that you're giving this case is going to cause other hospitals across the country to ask themselves, could this happen here? And you know what the answer is going to be? Yes, it could.
But so much of it just
taken at other hospitals.
But so much of why the protocol wasn't followed had to do with these ambiguous relationships we've been talking about between the physician, the medical personnel, and the patient's, you know, advocates, and the physician and the nurses and pharmacists. There were protocols in place, and they didn't follow them.
Well, none of the nurses apparently went up the chain of command,
right,
as far as we know.
Right.
Then they should have followed that. But I guarantee you, I believe that a nurse, if an electronic record had flagged this as a lethal dose,
yeah,
there's probably no nurse that would give that medication. And that's what these were. So when the order comes back and the order is placed, this is a lethal dose, I can't imagine a nurse questioning that. So if they're not educated, which is hard to believe they wouldn't be,
mm-hmm.
it would give them a reason to question the doctor and then go up this chain of command that we've talked about, which is so important. And this happens a lot in a lot of other types of cases, like baby cases where the doctors are not responding. The nurses then go up the chain of command. Hey, we've got some alarming fetal heart rates here. What do we do? And the doctor does nothing. They go up the chain of command, and there's a protocol for that. So OB nurses are very familiar with that and use it quite often.
What's your expectation about how this case unfolds, David Schroyer? At this point, we know that William Husel has met bail. Bail was set at $1 million. He's met that apparently, and he's out now. What's the trajectory at this point?
Well, you know, I mean, as in most cases, there'll probably be settlement negotiations at some point. I mean, when you're facing 25 potential life terms, you know, there's a big difference if you can work out a plea or if you roll the dice and go to trial. You know, sometimes when you do that, you pay rent for the courtroom. So we'll have to see how all that turns out.
I have heard that Husel is interested in trying to defend himself at trial, according to his attorney.
So he's going all the way. Okay.
Well, of course, that's what everybody's going to say. That's what
right.
everybody says. But at the end, we'll have to see what happens. His defense is that, well, there's a statute under Ohio law that provides me immunity for giving drugs for pain medication. Now, that's an interesting argument because it says you are allowed to give pain medication to relieve pain, and even though that pain medication may cause death, you would have immunity, but you have to exercise it, titrate it, means a little bit at a time,
okay.
and give it judiciously. Those are two big words in the statute. Neither one of those were followed in this case. This was not a judicious administration of fentanyl, nor was it titrated in any way. It was one IV push all at once.
How much time, at what point, we're just about out of time, David Schroyer, and I really appreciate your time today. How much time does this have to play out? Or he could just keep, you know, it could be the day before they go to trial, there could be a negotiation.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Anytime. It could even occur during trial.
Right. Okay.
So it could happen at any time. Then the civil cases will probably follow that. Our civil cases are set for about 18 months from now.
Okay.
So the criminal case will probably be over by that time.
David Schroyer, attorney for four of the families whose loved ones were victims of alleged murder by the prosecutor in Franklin County. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
And thanks for listening. Thanks to Paige Flager for joining us as well. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Ann.
That's it. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.